accession number 6287, reel 4.
Mr. Hood, reel 4.
Sesto Fiorentino is a working-class town, small working-class town. It's now a suburb of Florence. But it was solidly proletarian and solidly red, so much so that we were able to come down from the mountain, Monte Morello, and spend the night in Sesto Fiorentino, walk about fully armed, without any danger whatsoever. And it was from places like Sesto Fiorentino, from Campi, from Florence itself, that we got our supplies, our money, ammunition and everything else coming up by messengers. It was highly organised and very good.
What kind of arms did they have?
We had Italian muskets. That gives you a false impression. It was the standard modern rifle of the Italian army. They had a very old one, an 1898 model, and then this new one, which had been introduced under Mussolini. And they were very ineffective. They had a very short barrel, quite a high velocity, and it was very difficult to aim with them at all. They were very bad sights. And we had a machine gun, and they had mortars, which were in a different part of the mountains, and we didn't have them with us. And the machine gun, we had two belts of cartridges for, and the machine gunner of the detachment was a Sardinian who, like an idiot, took out one belt and fired it all off in a quarry, and then had the mistaken idea of putting tracer every fifth round on the other belt. And when it came to the fight in the barn, the machine gun jammed it every fifth round, so he had to clear it every fifth round, and he was in fact killed. But they were quite well armed.
What was the role of the group seen to be?
The role of the group was actually, it hadn't done anything so far. It simply gathered, and it was going to go up and join one of the big brigades, Garibaldi brigades, which was gathering in the high Apennines, and which then became involved in a number of big actions up in the top there. The group I was with in the Chianti area, in fact, were two groups. There was the part I'd fallen in with was a monarchist group, which was under the command of a major who had a country estate there. And there was the major, there was a captain, and there was an Italian parachutist lieutenant. And they had organised a lot of the peasants, who were much more radical than the officers were, actually. But there was also, quite close by, there was a nucleus of a communist organisation. And my difficult job was to act as liaison officer between the two groups. There was a communist political commissar, basically, stationed in a small village to whom I always went to get instructions, and my job was to try and coordinate activities. And we carried out minor acts of sabotage. We locked down telephone poles, we laid explosive charges on the road at night where the German traffic was going to be. We attacked, I was ill that day, but they attacked a German convoy and destroyed trucks. We captured a German truck. When I went into Siena, I carried with me a load of explosives. There were explosive pencils which you could put under the seat of a car, on the bonnet of a car. And that was the worst moment, because Siena being a walled town, the Germans had sentries on all the gates, and they did spot checks. So with another guy, we had to walk through that and just hope we weren't spot checked, because we had a lot of stuff on us. But there was one really frightening moment when the major had relatives down on the coast of on the Maremma. The Maremma is a very sort of desolate part of the coast, south of Pisa. And he went down and he made contact with a British submarine. And eventually, from some source that I've never been clear about, we had instructions that at a given point we were to seize and hold a particular village on the German communications routes. So we planned all that, and I was not optimistic about it because it seemed to me like total suicide. I mean, we were 20 or 30 people with some Stens, some rifles, some hand grenades, but no heavy weapons. It seemed to me just totally mad proposal altogether. However, that eventually fell through. We didn't do it just as well.
Can you tell me about something that you hinted at earlier about the removal of officers to Germany from Camp 21?
Yes. Camp 21 was this very large camp at Kieti. Now, I believe it's true to say that the senior British officers had orders, or certainly said they had orders in some cases, to stay where they were in the event of a takeover or anything falling apart. So that one day the inhabitants of Camp 21 woke up to find that there were no Italian guards on the sentry. There was nobody there at all. So they said, OK, this is where we get out. We go, as we had done up north. And the stories I have heard it from people who were there was that the senior British officer said, no, you may not do so, and in fact set his own guards on the sentry boxes. Now, various people said, this is crazy, the Germans are going to come, and they proceeded to hide themselves in the roof of the bungalows, which was quite easy, including a friend of mine who did get through. And then one morning they woke up and found there were Germans on the sentry boxes. And the Germans then proceeded to take the entire camp, except for those they couldn't find, load them on trains and took them up into Germany. And those who did manage to get away, who'd hidden in the roofs, were lucky because the Germans went and fired machine pistols into the roofs, but didn't seem to have killed any. But those people who did manage to stay behind and get away came through the lines in a matter of 10 days, a fortnight, that sort of thing, because the lines were very close. But all the rest went up to Germany. And that's a somewhat murky story, of which a number of people know about better than I do.
I think you've got a story about an officer who declined to escape from the train.
Yes, this was an officer who was, for reasons which now escaped me, was taken from Italy to Germany by truck. And he was alone in it with a German driver. And when he got to Germany, I know what it was, he'd been in hospital. And then when they were all taken away up to Germany from Camp 21, he had to rejoin them. And when he did eventually rejoin them, he described his journey all through France. And they said to him, well, why not didn't you jump off the truck? And he said, well, I couldn't leave all that stuff I had in the back. You know, he had his deck chair and his books and his gramophone records, whatever it was. And he had not been able to part with these belongings, which in a very interesting way were part of his attempt to set up some sort of structure for his life. And he couldn't bear the thought of being deprived of all belongings again, which is a traumatic experience, certainly.
Do you think that your own period as a POW left any effects with you?
We used to discuss that. We were of the opinion that to be a prisoner for not more than a year was probably quite good for the soul in some way. It was a very interesting experience. I think it taught one a lot about how to live with people, how to get on with people, how to avoid unnecessary frictions. I'm not sure it was very positive. Yes, I learned a lot in the period, one way or another. And the time I was out of between the month between September 1943 and about July 1944, that I think taught me a lot about self-reliance, about making very difficult decisions like having people shot and things of that sort. that I think do leave a mark of some kind. We were waiting for our arms drop, and I was told that there was a man too many. So I went along and looked at him and spoke to him and interrogated him for a long time. He was a kid of about 19, Sardinian. And he was totally incapable of explaining who he was, where he'd come from. He gave about three different versions of how he'd got there. So I simply said, eventually he's going to be shot. And we shot him. Because he'd seen the dropping zone, he'd seen everybody who was there. It was just a risk we couldn't take. And in the same way, I had a German deserter shot, because he deserted. The South Africans were a very difficult bunch to deal with. There were a number of South African escaped prisoners in that area. And I was visiting a peasant family one day when they suddenly turned up with a guy in German uniform. So I said, well, what the hell do you think this is? And they said, well, he's a deserter. And he says he wants to stay with us. And he did stay with them. And they were camped in the woods. And eventually he began to say, well, look, it's perfectly safe. You know, I can get you into Siena. Why don't we go down and have a night on the town or something? And they came and reported this to me. So I simply said, well, you got him, you get rid of him. And they shot him. But they... what he was, I have no idea. There's no way of telling.
Do you think that your period as a POW left any permanent physical impairment?
No, I was extremely healthy. I once had a bit of flu, but I was never ill then, or throughout the whole period, I was never really ill. I got dysentery occasionally, that was all.
Did it change your attitude towards the Italians?
Yes, because, when I got out of the second camp, Camp 49 near Parma, one of the first families I was put up by in a farm was an ex-guard of the prisoner of war camp, who said to me, look, you people called it Camp 49, we called it Camp 50. And he was, you know, totally opposed to the war, the peasant, didn't see the point of the war, didn't like Mussolini. And what one found, of course, talking to the peasantry and to the workers round about Florence, was that they were solidly against fascism. From a way back, had seen through it absolutely, so that, you know, what conventionally is described as the cowardice of the Italian soldiers in North Africa was them voting with their feet. They didn't see, rightly, they didn't see why the hell they should be killed for Mussolini and his African adventures. So, you know, why should we? What's the point? But when it came to resistance, they were of extreme courage and bravery. Amazing people. Absolutely amazing. Hair-raising courage, I guess. And taking immense risks, because any family that I stayed with, if I was found with them, they were liable to be shot or put in concentration camp or deported somewhere or another. And they took that risk, you know, like that. And they're amazing. I lived with one family in Chianti for about 3 or 4 months, I suppose. They were just marvellous.
Did you make any permanent Italian friends as a result of your experience?
Yes, I've gone back and lived with various families. And last summer I went back and visited one particular lot, chiefly as an exercise in oral history, because the University of Florence was doing an exercise on the attitude of the peasantry towards escape prisoners of war. They're doing a big thing on that. And there were some people, by curious coincidence, they'd chosen the village in which I'd been hidden. And indirectly, through the archives in Washington, they found out about me and got in touch with me. And they said, look, you're the only person who can get some people to talk. So I went back and got them to talk about that period, exactly why they'd done it and what they thought about it at the time. And what emerged was that, yes, of course there were humanitarian elements at play, but at the same time, the fact of having a prisoner of war was also a kind of political insurance policy. And that very deliberately, the partisan intelligence officer placed me with a family which in the past had fascist connections, because that was the price they were having to pay to be in the clear by the liberation. They were very nice people, and they'd got to like me, and I got to like them. But that was the deal. They were prepared to have me if he was prepared to see them all right at the liberation. That's how it worked. I was quite, they were quite open about this nowadays. They said, well, yes, of course. And also the other thing that became obvious was that the fact that they had me and I was kept in the skate teeth was known to the entire village. Everybody knew about it. But it was one of these open secrets. And they gained prestige from the fact that they had me and that I was an officer. So these fed into the situation, which I was not aware of at the time, but thinking about it ought to have been aware of. On the other hand, their mother, who was an old woman, she was quite clearly inspired by sort of Christian principles of, you know, you feed the hungry and you look after the homeless and so forth. I think she was genuinely that way. But the two brothers, who her sons, who ran the place, they knew what to on about.
How much danger was there of pro-fascist or pro-German Italians giving you away?
A bit, but not in a small community like that. But one had to be conscious of it. Although, as the Allies drew nearer, of course, the fascists began to, you know, hedge their bets very heavily. And it became, in fact, one could intimidate fascists very easily. Somebody said, look, by the time the Allies come, if you don't behave, in the meantime, we will deal with you. And in fact, when I went into Siena, I had with me an identity card, which was eventually signed by the mayor of Siena. Because the resistance went to him and said, look, you know, either you sign these or we deal with you. And he signed a whole lot of them. We all had these false identity cards. In fact, I was a member of the auxiliary police in Siena for about a week, I suppose.
Was there ever any taking of revenge against fascists? As
yes, yes. In Siena, there was a sort of hit list, which they were, you know, they were trying to get through before the Allies came. And when I got into Siena, I was told to make contact, first of all, with the head of the resistance in Siena, or the military head, anyway, who was a Sicilian. And in a very typical Sicilian way, he was sort of still in his pyjamas at about 11 in the morning, very leisurely, and eventually he got dressed. He said, let's go for a walk through the town. When we went out of the house, I saw two men get up in front and two men behind. So I said to him, well, who are these? He said, oh, these are my assassins. We walked in this bodyguard through the town, and they were the killers, actually. They were going through, getting rid of people.
Were they Sicilians as well?
I never managed to talk to them, I don't know.
I think there's something that you'd like to add about escapes.
Yes, escapes were very important in prisoner of war life, and they fulfilled a number of functions. There were those people who really wanted to escape. There were those people who went through the motions of wishing to escape. In other words, they were involved in very arduous and protracted exercises of digging or carrying spoil and generally being involved. And there were those who didn't want to know about it. Three categories. And of course, escapes depended on a lot of collaboration. For instance, in Camp 49 near Parma, there was one good escape, which we went in this way, in that there was an internal perimeter of wire around the orphanage in which we were kept, but beyond that there was a sort of playing field which we were allowed into during the day, but at night the guards fell back onto the inner perimeter. So a series of boxing matches were arranged with a very thick crowd all around the boxing match. And under cover of this, a pit was dug and was then two people got into it, and deck chairs were put over, and the whole thing was then covered with sods and earth. So they stayed there all day, and then at night they went through the outer wire very easily and got away. They got up to the Swiss frontier, actually. Now, in the meantime, what one had to do was to cover for them. And the way we did it was this, that I and another man reported sick in our beds. Now, when the roll call was being taken outside, an Italian orderly officer went through all the rooms to check that nobody was there. So he came into the room where I normally slept, and there I was in bed, of moaning and groaning under the sheet. But, you know, he always went the same way around the building. So when he left the room, I then dashed out with another man who'd also been sick in another bed, climbed up the floor above, and there we were in different postures in bed, so that there must have been four people gone. No, two. So we filled up for them too, yes? So the numbers were absolutely correct. We were missing from roll call, and there were two other people who could be accounted for, so that the tally was correct. And we'd given an undertaking to the escapers to keep us up for 48 hours. We did that successfully, and they were not stopped actually till right up on the frontier. And that was quite a good escape actually in some way.
When you categorise the POWs into the three categories, and you said that the second category consisted of those who went through the motions, did you mean that on the surface they wanted to escape, but in reality they didn't?
Yes, that was my feeling, that it was a way of passing time, but they really weren't too anxious for it actually to happen. Because, you see, the problem about escaping was this, and this was one of the problems raised by the breakout on the 8th of September, that if the prisoner of war camp was functioning well in terms of living conditions, food, comforts, companionship, one thing or another, and people had actually got stuff together, it required a moment of courage to leave all that behind and to go into something totally unknown, many people not speaking a language, not knowing the situation, not knowing what on earth to do next. That was quite difficult, I think, to take that step out of what, in fact, was a kind of safety into a very dangerous unknown.